A fatal trip home to Bangladesh. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Two students from Emory University were killed in that cafe attack in Bangladesh. One of them grew up there.
So it was his home. It wasn't like he was going to a foreign country. He was going home.
We'll hear how the attack has shaken the Bangladeshi community at Emory. Also, an Indian engineer raised in the U.S. now working to get more people to use toilets in India.
We as an organization believe that people want to use toilets. Then there is usually some other barrier that is preventing them from using it.
Plus, what scientists want the spacecraft Juno to find out about Jupiter.
So they want to understand the proportions of hydrogen, helium, and other heavier elements in Jupiter's interior.
All that and more today on The World. I was just remarking how on today's show, we begin and end with two different versions of The Global Village. A man from India who came to the U.S. with the aim of making it big time in Silicon Valley, only to wake up his musical talents. He's now a blues musician. That's later on The World. But we start with a South Asian woman from the States who went the other way to Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. Her name was Abinta Kabir. She was a student at Emory University. Faraz Hossein was also a student from Emory. He was with Abinta last Friday, dining with their friend Tarishi Jain, a sophomore from the University of California, Berkeley. The three students, each with strong ties to Bangladesh, were among 20 hostages killed when the cafe was attacked by men with guns and knives. This week, students, faculty, and members of the Bengali diaspora at Berkeley and Emory are holding vigils for Abinta, Faraz, and Tarishi. Let me turn to Sultana Begum in Atlanta. She's the founder of the Bengali Association of Students at Emory, or BASE, and she just graduated from Emory. Sultana, it's such a tragic event. What are people at Emory saying about the attack on the cafe in Dhaka? How have they been reaching out to you?
Everyone, I think, is just shocked. You know, I mean, Abinta was going to go visit her friends and family. Faraz was going to go do an internship in Dhaka. You know, he was raised there. So it was his home. It wasn't like he was going to a foreign country. He was going home. And so I think for the Bengali community, especially in Atlanta, it's very shocking because something like this has never happened in Bangladesh. You know, it's very unprecedented.
So two students kind of from the Bangladeshi diaspora from Emory. And then there was the young woman from UC Berkeley as well, all in Dhaka for the summer. What would you say is their connection to the country? I mean, is there an identity thing that they were also looking for?
I think for all of us, it's identity. It's really hard being a Bangladeshi, I think, or Bengali, and being raised in the United States, you kind of, you know, it's hard meeting other Bengali students. You know, at Emory, there's only like 50 people here who consider themselves Bengali, and a large majority of them are actually from Calcutta or India.
When people ask you, like, how do you highlight the differences between Indians, Pakistanis, and Bengalis, what do you say?
You know, I say that we were East Pakistan at one point. We were a part of Pakistan. You know, we gained our independence in 1971 with the help of India. We have a large Islamic community, but we also have about 15% Hindus. We are unique because of our language. We speak Bengali, we speak Bangla, but we are also a very secular nation, or we'd like to think we are, you know, at least before this happened.
Sultana, I gather you're helping to organize a vigil for Abinta and Faraz on Thursday. What are you planning?
We are planning an interfaith vigil on Thursday at 1 p.m. here at Emory's campus. And we're going to have prayers from five different traditions. We are going to have reflections from a couple of friends of Faraz and Abinta's, and we're going to have a couple of poems from the Bangladeshi tradition. Both of the students were Muslims, so we're going to have a formal call to prayer. I don't know. We're
expecting
a lot. A
point that has not been lost on a lot of people who've been watching what happened. This was claimed by IS, and the victims were Muslim.
Exactly.
Let me ask you this, finally. A lot of people commented that attacks like this don't often happen in Bangladesh. What does it feel like for you to be so far away from your home country that might be changing a lot more rapidly than we thought?
It's scary. And you know, people are fearing that it's just the start of many potentially. And that's what scares me the most. And I fear that the youth who are so proud to be Bangladeshi, who are so proud to be Bengali, who aspire to go back home and do good for our countries are, I don't know how the mood will change, you know. I don't know if that's going to change in any way, but I hope not.
Sultana Begum, founder of the Bengali Association for Students at Emory or BASE. Thanks very much, Sultana. Good to speak with you.
Thanks.
If it feels like you've been hearing about a lot of attacks lately, you've been paying attention. In addition to Bangladesh, there have been terrorist attacks in Turkey, in Iraq, and on Monday in Saudi Arabia. The ones in the Saudi kingdom were three suicide bombings. One targeted the U.S. consulate in the city of Jeddah. Another took place in the Shia city of Qatif. Matthew Bell is on the religion beat for The World, and he tells us the third attack in Medina was on a mosque, but not just any mosque.
It was the Mosque of the Prophet, the place where Muhammad himself is believed to be buried, and it's one of the two holiest places for Muslims from all over. The other is the city of Mecca, also in Saudi Arabia. The fact that someone blew himself up in Medina during the holiest days of the month of Ramadan and killed four security guards who had reportedly offered to break the fast with the bomber, it all makes this particular attack especially appalling to Muslims. Some are calling it an attack on Islam itself. ISIS did not claim immediate responsibility for the Medina attack, but Fahad Nasser, a former political analyst at the Saudi embassy in Washington, says the group's fingerprints are all over it.
I think ISIS and its followers have been fairly clear in saying that Saudi Arabia is their ultimate prize. I think they're doing everything they can to create a sense of instability. They've certainly tried to foment sectarian discord in Saudi Arabia by targeting the Shia minority in the eastern province. And I think they've largely failed in that attempt, for sure.
The attack in Medina seems to have brought a new wave of condemnation of ISIS from fellow Muslims, says Hassan Hassan. He's the author of the book ISIS Inside the Army of Terror.
Listen, if there's one feature that sets ISIS apart from even Al-Qaeda, it's that ISIS has declared a war against Islam and against Muslims. You know, this is what the organization is all about.
Hassan explains the ideology of ISIS this way. Anyone who fails to swear allegiance to the group is the enemy, and they can be killed. And that includes most Muslims, who make up the majority of the victims of ISIS. Hassan says the bombings in Medina and elsewhere might be shocking, but he says he's not surprised if ISIS is responsible for these kinds of attacks.
There are statements by Abu Muhammad al-Julani, the spokesperson of ISIS, saying it doesn't matter if you pray and fast or if you turn your face towards Mecca and pray. There's nothing that immunizes you or makes you immune from killing if you don't pledge allegiance to us.
The latest surge of violence could be due to the fact that ISIS is losing territory in Iraq and Syria, but eventually the sheer brutality of ISIS could become the group's undoing. Hassan says it's fueling a movement by Muslims against ISIS and what it stands for.
A movement that rejects these ideas and maybe engage even in soul searching, like where does this organization comes from and why we have a group like that that believes in this sort of things.
But Hassan adds that ISIS has proven itself to be resilient. He says it only takes small numbers of fanatics for the group to carry on and attract new recruits. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
We are there. We are in orbit. We conquered Jupiter. That's how one NASA scientist put it today. It's taken 5 years, but now NASA's solar-powered spacecraft Juno has made it all the way to Jupiter. Amy Barr Molinar is at the Planetary Science Institute in Arizona. She's an expert on the origins of planets. And I asked her what happens now that Juno is in Jupiter's orbit.
Well, I think the challenge now is to get all the instruments up and running and to start executing their prime mission. They want to understand the composition of Jupiter. That's one of the main goals. That's the one that I'm the most interested in. So they want to understand the proportions of hydrogen, helium, and other heavier elements in Jupiter's interior. That's one of the main goals.
Right. And so Jupiter is a gaseous planet. Is it frozen gas? Is it literally gaseous, that entire planet?
Well, that's part of what we're trying to find out. So the outermost of Jupiter is gas. And as you go down into Jupiter's interior, you pass through many levels of sort of cloud decks. That's why Jupiter has that really interesting appearance with all of those orange and white and yellow clouds. And then once you pass below those cloud decks, the gas starts to become more compressed and it starts to behave in a different way. So all of the, you know, as you compress the gas further and further and you go deeper in the interior at higher pressures, at some point, like all the electrons pop off the molecules. And at that point, we don't really know what's happening inside Jupiter or how that type of material behaves. That's something that we don't really understand very well. But what Juno will hopefully be able to tell us is the composition of the atmosphere. And most importantly, whether Jupiter has a solid core underneath all of that gas. I really want to know whether Jupiter has a core or not and how big that core is.
How much of this is right now just flying blind?
Well, I think people have some pretty good ideas of what they think might be going on inside Jupiter. But I think one of the main things that Juno will help us figure out is it will help us put some of the previous measurements of Jupiter's atmosphere into context. The Galileo probe went to Jupiter, and we got some very, very strange data back from the Galileo probe. And one thing that I hope Juno will do is help us understand that data a little bit better.
Data about what?
Well, they measured the compositions of certain gases, like noble gases like argon, krypton, and xenon. And they also measured the compositions of things like methane and ammonia and hydrogen sulfide. And they found that Jupiter was very, very enriched in those materials, which would suggest that perhaps Jupiter does have a core composed of things like carbon, which is one of the atoms that's in methane, and nitrogen, which is in ammonia, and sulfur, which is in hydrogen sulfide. So it seemed from those measurements that Jupiter might have a core. But then when they measured water, they found that Jupiter was really, really depleted in water. And so that would argue against the presence of a core in Jupiter. Mm. And so that's been very confusing to people to try to understand why that happened.
And even more basic than whether Jupiter has a core or not, I mean, is there a hypothesis about how and where Jupiter formed that scientists are trying to test?
Well, yeah, certainly. So it turns out that the presence or absence of a core inside Jupiter is very important for determining how it formed. So the two main ideas are that Jupiter accreted from a core of sort of icy, rocky material. And then that core got so big that it started to grab gas from the solar nebula. And the alternate theory is just that Jupiter represents a piece of the solar nebula that collapsed onto itself to make a planet, in which case it would not have a core.
Wow. Will any of the answers to these questions help us here on Earth better understand where we come from?
I think so, because, you know, understanding the timescale over which Jupiter formed, you know, if it formed in the first million years of the life of the solar nebula, or it formed in maybe the first 10 or 20 million years of the lifetime of the solar system, that could kind of help us understand the timeline for planet formation in our solar system.
Amy Barb-Linar, senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson, Arizona. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
This is The World. Something you'll have probably seen if you've ever been to India, men who casually use a street as their toilet. It's kind of incredible, a country where kissing in public is frowned on, but hardly anyone bats an eye if you defecate in public. It's become a big public health problem. India has a significant shortage of toilets, something the government of Narendra Modi has pledged to fix. But Anoop Jain is already working on that. He grew up here, the son of Indian immigrants, and he started the group Sanitation and Health Rights in India. They build toilets in Bihar, one of the poorest states in the country. And those toilets, they also provide clean water. I asked Anoop Jain how it all works.
So what we do is we build toilets free to use by the public. Each facility has 16 toilets, 8 for men, 8 for women. The waste is collected in a large underground tank, and the waste decomposes to form methane gas, and that methane gas is an energy source. So we use it to generate electricity, and that electricity is used to power a water filtration plant, and we then sell the safe drinking water to communities for a nominal fee.
Wow, and how have the communities taken to this whole system?
Yeah, so we have four facilities that are up and running. We see between 3,000 and 4,000 women, men, and children using the facilities every single day. And we are selling over 100,000 liters of safe drinking water every single month.
Anup, I had a conversation recently with a reporter, Ritu Chatterjee, who was based in Delhi. And she said the government is building toilets, but has not always been successful getting people to use them. How have you encountered the toilet education problem, and how have you dealt with it?
So we as an organization really believe and assume that people want to use toilets. Then there is usually some other deterrent or barrier that is preventing them from using it. So in the case of the government toilets, the government is building pit latrines. So when the pit fills up with the waste, families are expected to empty it themselves or pay a handsome sum to the government to empty it for them. So families, unfortunately, can't afford to empty their pit. What that would mean is that they would be left to empty it on their own. And no family really wants to do that, especially in areas where the caste system is still so deeply entrenched, because they don't want to be associated with the so-called untouchable caste, which still, in so many parts of India, is responsible for emptying out human waste.
Mm. Anup, it's interesting. You're American, the son of Indian immigrants. What is it like for you working in the country where your parents are from? Do people treat you like a foreigner?
Yeah, I think it's definitely difficult. In the U.S., I very much consider myself a person of color, whereas in India, I am seen as an American. And so I'm constantly struggling.
Like
to
a white American?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, I speak Hindi. You know, my accent is very poor. I definitely dress differently than other Indian males my age. So I think that for me, there is a big disconnect. And that's tough.
What was a recent challenging experience for you where Indians treated you, as you say, like an American?
Yeah, I was in the village in February. We were about to open our third facility. And we try to preferentially treat the lowest caste Indians, so-called untouchables, because those are the communities least likely to receive services. So we're working in this community, and our construction workers started complaining to us saying, oh, the upper caste, the Brahmin kids keep coming over and yelling at us and insulting us. Can you guys do something about it? Mm. So one evening we sort of stayed back a little bit later, and these, you know, 18, 19-year-old guys came up to us, and they basically just started yelling at us and threatening us and threatening our workers. They are afraid that the low caste people are getting these services and they're going to get forgotten or left behind. I was trying to speak in Hindi, and then one of the young men started speaking to me in really good English. And he was basically telling me that I just didn't know what I was doing or what I had gotten myself into. It was an incredible dose of humility, because it just reminded me that I'm not from there. This young man said, why don't you work on employment issues? So many of me and my friends were all unemployed in this state. It's so poor, you know? And he said, you know, you're out here trying to build toilets. You think you're doing the right thing. What about getting me a job, right? And, you know, it's easy for me to label him as a high caste Indian. But relatively speaking, you know, he still comes from a poor family.
What did you say to him when he said, why don't you get me a job?
You know, I basically was trying to explain to him that, you know, we try to first and foremost give jobs to the poorest of the poor. And he said, who are you to decide who's poor here?
Hmm. So it's challenging work and seemingly valuable work. Anup, I'm curious, what is your critique on toilets and sanitation here in the U.S.?
Well, I think I was talking to some friends recently about the transgender laws. In India, we build toilets for men and women, and we have very strong rules at our facilities about keeping men separate from women because, you know, because it's very rural, very conservative. Men and women don't want any sort of commingling in a toilet space. Some of my friends were saying, so how do you deal with the transgender issue? I said, look, India as a society, especially rural India as a society, is nowhere near dealing with that as an issue. And it's too big for us to bite off at this particular time. But I think that for the U.S., it absolutely is an issue that needs to be addressed. It speaks to this more basic issue that we do face in India is, you just need a place to go. And when you need to go, you want to feel comfortable and you want to feel safe and you want to feel that your privacy is being preserved. And a certain group of people, in this case, transgender individuals, don't have that sense of safety, then we're doing something wrong.
Anoop Jain, founder of the group Sanitation and Health Rights in India. Great to speak with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we take a break, a quick update on a story from Iraq. One of the iconic images of the U.S.-led invasion was the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad's Furdoo Square on April 9, 2003. Iraqis joined with U.S. Marines to bring it down live on TV. One of those Iraqis was already a minor celebrity, an international weightlifter and wrestler named Kadim Sharif Hassan Al-Jabouri. And this week he spoke with our colleagues at the BBC.
On that day, I heard the Americans had arrived at the outskirts of Baghdad. I was very happy, and I got the sledgehammer, and I went to the square.
Jabouri was the big, bare-chested man caught on film with a giant sledgehammer smashing the base of the statue of the dictator. Jabouri is Sunni Muslim, like Saddam, and he was once a good friend of Saddam's son, Uday. They collected motorbikes together. But there was an argument, and Jabouri wound up in prison for 18 months. So he was happy to see the end of Saddam's regime. Right now, though, he isn't so happy.
I'd like to rebuild the statue, to put it up again, because Saddam has gone and we have 1,000 Saddams now. They destroyed the country. They are thieves and killers. Look at the killings. It's very clear. There was no corruption or looting. It was safe. This government has turned the clock back 100 years.
Many Iraqis do not share Jabouri's nostalgia for the law and order of Saddam Hussein, but there is no shortage of anger at Iraq's current government, especially after the latest attacks in Baghdad. As for Jabouri, he left Iraq years ago. He now lives in Beirut in Lebanon. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Most Buddhist monks in Thailand are men, but not all.
Enlightenment is the quality of mind that goes beyond. You see, so there is no gender there. So when you talk about the supreme spiritual goal in Buddhism, it's genderless.
Thailand's rebellious female monks, that's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We had a question here in the newsroom. How could the Brexit vote affect soccer? Because right now, the two top leagues in England and Scotland have a combined 332 Europeans on them. They're some of the best players on the planet. It's what makes the Premier League the Premier League. And it's all due to European players being able to work in Britain. Brexit could put that in jeopardy. Or as Ken Bellison with the New York Times says, it could give soccer in the UK a gigantic headache.
The biggest problem, I think, when speaking about Brexit is the freedom of movement that European nationals have within the 28 member nation bloc. And if Britain leaves, it will no longer have that same movement. So it'll be harder, basically, for English teams in the Premier League to get players from the continent.
You haven't mentioned the English players because one would assume that if some of the European players are not able to come to the UK, maybe this helps out the English wannabe players. Is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, you'd have no visa issue. And some of the regulations that the English Football Association pushed the government to adopt didn't really matter much, but they would go in effect if England and the rest of the UK left the European Union. So those would, in fact, make it much harder for younger players to come to England to train and play on youth clubs. And it would, again, make it harder for European stars to come over.
I mean, Brexit is so complex, but the way you talk about it, Ken, soccer sounds like a really good prism in which to view the entire Brexit campaign, local versus global. Like Britain could, might be good again if it focuses on Britain and Britain alone, as in soccer. You agree with that?
Yeah, I think there's a portion of the Leave campaign, the folks who wanted Brexit, which wanted the so-called Little England, wanted England or Britain to focus on itself. And, you know, I guess in soccer terms, that would be promoting English players and not having them compete as much or have to compete as much with French and Spanish and other players. There's others who say that, in fact, it levels the playing field, that it's a deregulation. It makes England less tied to one block of countries, meaning the EU, and allows every country to compete for goods and services with England and vice versa. So in a sense, there's some people who say, well, this will make it easier for Americans to show up or South Americans or people from other places. So I don't think there's uniformity in the view that it's a nativist campaign. There's others who saw it in broader terms in a deregulatory way.
Ken, you know how powerful English Premier League is as an organization. If freedom of movement gets put in check by Brexit, wouldn't Premier League just bend the rules?
Absolutely. The folks that we spoke to for this story pretty much all contended that at the end, the EPL is such a powerful force, both within England and globally, that they would be able to lobby for some exemptions. And there are in other cases similar kinds of exemptions for, say, scientific researchers, academics. You could carve out parts of it that would make it easy for talented athletes to cross borders. It'd be a little bit difficult because you have to prove why this athlete would be able to come in visa-free versus another. But I suppose there's ways to come up with statistics to prove how one player is more talented than another. So in the end, they could find a solution by being exempt. You know, it's not just the English Premier League. It's the broadcasters who put out their games and other companies who sponsor teams. These are all powerful lobby groups, and they could weigh in on the issue as well. So we could see, in a sense, a carve-out on this issue, and in a sense, the worst-case scenario might not occur.
Ken Belson with the New York Times, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Another and quick Brexit-related sports note. You soccer fans out there will know that the Euro 2016 tournament is going on in France right now. England's national team was eliminated a few days ago by Iceland. Many called that a second British exit from Europe. But actually, there's still one British team in the tournament, Wales.
Go on, wait, you kids up. Something special is happening here tonight.
That's how the BBC TV announcer summed up the Welsh win over Belgium in a quarterfinal match. Tomorrow it's on to the semifinal against Portugal. That is the furthest Wales has ever gone in a major soccer tournament. And Welsh coach Chris Coleman says he won't let this whole Brexit thing distract his players.
Talking about being in or out of Europe, we're still in it, and that's all we care about, to be honest, as a team. So that's not our focus. We'll talk about that when we get back.
Tomorrow's semifinals, also a showdown between two of the world's best players, Portugal's Cristiano Ronaldo versus Gareth Bale of Wales. So at this point, it's anybody's bet who wins. When I went to Iran for the first time earlier this year, I had a few reference points. One, the Western media portrayal of Iran that gives you a limited picture of the country. And two, the films of Abbas Kiarostami. We got news yesterday that Kiarostami died of cancer at the age of 76. Now, of those two sources of information, I found that in many ways, Kiarostami's Iran was the one I recognized more when I was on the ground. Saeed Kamali Degan writes for The Guardian in London and was previously their man in Tehran. I was only in Tehran for a week, Saeed, so let me ask you, how would you describe Abbas Kiarostami's Iran?
He's quite realistic about the real Iran, and it's been a struggle for Iranians, especially in the past few decades, to say that the real Iran is different from what you see in the West. Usually in the media, it's usually a binary black and white picture. And when you see Iranian films, you know, through Abbas Kiarostami, you see a different Iran, which is quite, I think, is more accurate. I lived there all my life, you know. I was born in Iran. Thanks to Kiarostami, we have a more realistic picture of Iran. What is extraordinary about Kiarostami is that, unlike some of, you know, other Iranian filmmakers, he stayed in Iran after the revolution and managed to make beautiful films despite the censorship that we have, huge censorship. Everything in Iran, if you want to make a film, you have to submit everything about it to the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, as it's called.
Mm.
And they have to vet everything. And Kiarostami managed to work in that, stay in that society in the first place, and then make films and make beautiful films and make a big impact. And I think he managed to do it.
And he didn't stay away from politics. Did his success on the international stage ever mean the censors in Iran gave him a pass?
When he won the Palme d'Or in 1997 at Cannes, when he returned to Iran, you would imagine this is the first Iranian filmmaker achieving this sort of recognition in international platforms. He would receive a hero's welcome. But he didn't. You know, the Iranians were quiet about it. They didn't appreciate him as much. And the state narrative was that, you know, they associated him with, you know, the West, so they didn't appreciate it. It wasn't all over the place, as you would have imagined. But years have gone past, and Kiarostami has stayed firm. You know, and more people know about him in Iran. More people know about him in the outside world. But one of the probably tragic things about Kiarostami is that, you know, he wasn't seen as in Iran as much as he was seen outside Iran. So he's a big name outside Iran. You know, everybody knows in Iran, knows who is Kiarostami, but not everybody has watched his films because the cinemas were not showing most of his films. So I never watched any of his films on Iranian cinemas or on Iranian national TV. I got them from CDs and DVDs. But Iranians have got used to that. You know, anything that is on screens in America now, you can find them in Iran. And some of them, you've visited Iran, you can, you know, spoken to Iranians, you know, some of them on pirated DVDs.
Probably a greater likelihood that young Iranians have seen Breaking Bad as opposed to any of Kiarostami's films.
Yeah, I think that's a shame. But, you know, Kiarostami was not necessarily a Hollywood popular filmmaker. He was an elite, you know, intellectual filmmaker. And I think he's already had a big impact. Asghar Farhadi, the Oscar winning of the film A Separation, he said that it was because of Kiarostami he paved the ways for Iranian cinema to be seen outside Iran. Iranian literature has not been as successful, Iranian music has not been as successful, but Iranian cinema is known outside, especially in Europe, especially in France. Now, I was looking at Le Monde today, Kiarostami's death was on the front page of Le Monde. I was reading a statement by the French president, François Hollande, about Kiarostami. So he's had an amazing impact, I can say.
What kind of effect do you think Kiarostami's films had on Iran's image in the world at large?
What is interesting about Kiarostami is that he is an international filmmaker. It's not about Iran. His films are not about Iran. He wanted to make international movies, and I think he succeeded. When you watch Raise My Friend's Home, or when you watch Taste of Cherry, you're not thinking, I'm watching an Iranian film. I think you're thinking that you're watching a story that is international. It's about compassion or somewhere else. It's about, it poses a philosophical question, for example, in Taste of Cherry. I think that's why it's made him successful, because he hasn't limited himself. His primary concern was not improving Iranian image, although he did it successfully. I think he wanted to make art, and I think that's why we remember him today.
Saeed Kamali Degan with The Guardian in London. Thank you, Saeed.
Thank you.
Another story now about what we think we know about some parts of the world. Here in the West, there's this image of Buddhism as one of the most tolerant religions. But in Thailand, Buddhism still has a big gender hang-up, especially when it comes to women seeking full enlightenment as Buddhist monks. The world's Patrick Nguyen has that story.
It may seem serene, but this is the sound of rebellion. I'm with a group of Thai monks going house to house collecting alms or food from faithful Buddhists. And the chanting you hear, that's a blessing for the donors who are kneeling on the ground with their heads bowed. Now, these monks don't look very provocative. They're in orange robes and flip-flops, and some are middle-aged. But one thing does set them apart, and it's a big problem for the Buddhist hierarchy. All of them are women. Do you think of yourself as a rebel?
Never thought of myself as a rebel.
Never thought of yourself as a rebel?
Even though I might be one.
That's Dhammananda, the 72-year-old abbot, or abbess, rather, of a Buddhist temple. It's about 40 miles outside Bangkok in a small village next to a noisy highway. Thailand is one of the most Buddhist countries in the world. Almost everyone here follows an old-school tradition called Theravada. There are about 300,000 monks in Thailand, but only 100 of them are female. Each one is a renegade, defying the state-backed monastic order that says women shall not be ordained. Again, here's Dhammananda.
To go back to the Buddha's time, you know, it is said that if you can make offering to the monks, it's well and good. But if you can make offering to both monks and female monks, that's even better. This is in the text, Patrick.
It's true. Even in Buddha's time, there were female monks, 2,600 years ago. He stated explicitly, women can reach nirvana.
Enlightenment is the quality of mind that goes beyond. You see? So there is no gender there. So when you talk about the supreme spiritual goal in Buddhism, it's genderless.
So what gives? Really, it's just a technicality. The supreme Buddhist order in Thailand says to women, hey, you want to be a monk? You must be ordained by an existing female monk. But since they never started allowing female monks in the first place, well, sorry, there's no one to bring you into the fold. Tough luck.
So it's kind of catch-22 kind of thing.
In 2001, Dhammananda hacked the system. She flew to Sri Lanka, which does ordain women. Then she came home as the first fully ordained Theravada female monk practicing in Thailand. The National Buddhist Order still rejects all female monks as bogus, but in the streets, people kneel at their feet. Each week, the female monks silently walk the streets, single file, holding silver bowls, their robes the color of ripe mangoes. As they approach, people drop to their knees, scoop rice or curry into their bowls, and await their blessing. I ask one woman who donated hot soup, how did you feel the first time you saw a female monk? She says, it was a little weird. But she also thinks Thai society is ready for this. Men come out to greet them too. A 60-year-old businessman named Kiti tells me, look, there are still plenty of people who think women should be moms, not monks. But he disagrees. Actually, Dhammananda is both a monk and a mom, but contact with their sons is limited, as are all interactions with the opposite sex.
When your son comes to visit you, are you allowed to hug him?
No, that is the very hard part, particularly the oldest son. He really missed that.
What are the rules regarding grandchildren? Do you have very young grandchildren? Can you pick them up and play with them? That's not something I usually associate with monks.
Yes, the youngest one is a boy, a child, you know. I don't particularly hug him or hold him, but if he's falling, then I grab him.
Are there special insights that women can bring to the monkhood that maybe men wouldn't think about?
The fact that many women have been mothers before, mothers and grandmothers, they tend to understand problems in yet another level than the men.
I know as a monk you have to subdue your anger, but doesn't it make you a little bit irritated that people think that you shouldn't be allowed to be a monk?
That's their problem.
You don't feel irritated?
That's their own ignorance they have to overcome. I cannot put all the ignorance of the people in the whole world on my shoulder.
For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Nakhon Pathom, Thailand.
We have a Q&A with Dhammananda up on our website. She talks about everything from motherhood in the monkhood to missing high tea and blueberry cheesecake. That's over at PRI.org. This is The World. And this is The Blues, but wait for it, it's also Bollywood. This is bluesman Aki Kumar. He's got an unlikely but really fun story. When I spoke with him last week, he told me when, where, and why he became a blues musician.
My story is that I came to the United States when I was 18. I wanted to be a software engineer. I wanted to be bigger than Bill Gates. And none of them worked out, unfortunately, because I fell in love with the blues somewhere along the way. The San Francisco Bay Area has a very rich blues scene, a lot of world-class blues musicians. You know, I just fell into that scene and turned into a blues musician, and that's what I've been doing for the last few years.
Well, you discovered the blues here, but you began making music as a kid in India. What kind of music?
I dabble in music. I did train somewhat formally when I was very young, when I was 8 years old. My parents enrolled me in traditional Indian music classes, so it's called Hindustani music.
Music of the Asian subcontinent.
Right. And I never seriously thought that I would pursue this as a career, but I always knew that there was music inside of me and that I would always be involved in music one way or another.
So your instrument is the harmonica. I know it sits in the family tree of free reed instruments like the harmonium, which is popular in India and Pakistan.
Which I played a bit, actually.
You did. So and
very little, yeah.
And did that help learning the harmonica, or is there a role for the harmonica in Hindustani classical music?
There hasn't been traditionally. It's not to my knowledge. I know there have been a couple of efforts in trying to integrate it, but nothing I don't think that has been massively successful. I think perhaps the reason the harmonica or the chromatic harmonica is not part of Hindustani or Indian classical music is maybe because it's restricted in how much it can bend. And I think being able to bend notes and hit the microtones is kind of critical in Indian music.
So let's take a pause in the conversation and listen to music. This is a track called Ina Minadika. It goes back to 1957 when it was originally sung by the great Bollywood playback singer Asha Bhosle. Let's hear this. Ina Minadika, Dai Dominika, Maka Naka Naka, Chika Pika Rika, Ina Minadika, Dika Dai, Dai Dominika, Maka Naka, Maka Naka, Chika Pika Rola Rika, Ram Pam Po, Sharam Pam Po. That is a great tune. It starts off with that very rockabilly guitar and then takes its turn with you kind of doing Louis Prima in Hindi. So you stayed pretty true to the original there. But in some of your other music, I mean, what are you trying to do? What does this music tell us about the brain of Aki Kumar?
Well, you know, in songs where it felt just natural to sing and play the song the way it was, we kept it like that, like with Ina Minadika. But there's songs on the record like Janu Meri Jaan, I think that's track 7, where we infused Howling Wolf-inspired grooves on top of a song that was released in the 80s that sounds nothing like it. And somehow we made it work musically, and it does work musically.
Are you trying to be the best blues musician you can be, or is it important to you to kind of also introduce American audiences to what's going on in Bollywood music and Indian classical music?
Well, I originally did not set out to introduce American audiences to Indian music or any of that, quite honestly. My passion really lies in the blues, and that's what I consider to be a lifelong passion and a pursuit. But the reality is the more that I've grown as a blues musician, the more that I hear and appreciate other forms of music. And especially with relation to Bollywood and retro Bollywood, I started hearing all the blues influence, all the swing influence, like in that track, Ina Minadika. It's heavy swing going on. So
very heavy.
The better I got at blues, the more I started to appreciate all these great Bollywood songs that I knew growing up as a kid, but I had no idea that they were inspired by American music.
What a fascinating boomerang effect.
Yeah.
So the software company you work for currently in the Silicon Valley, can you tell us what it is?
Well, I don't work for it anymore. And this is one of my success stories as a musician is that I don't work for
That's
it
good
anymore.
News. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Did your colleagues, wherever you work, did they know you had this double life? And did you publicize
yes,
it?
Yes, they did. I didn't publicize it too much, but over the years it became something that was... You know, I had to kind of admit that I had this double life. I was getting in, coming in late to work, very tired because I'd spent the previous night, you know, playing at some blues club somewhere.
So a sign of success for you, Aki Kumar, is that you now get to sleep in?
Except for today. It's way, way too early. I don't even know what time
it
is.
I feel so guilty. I mean, you are a blues musician after all. You have to sleep past lunch.
That's funny. You know, that reminds me, I just read this meme. It said the biggest lie that blues musicians tell is that they start every song with, I woke up this morning.
That's a great one. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Aki sure. Kumar, so good to meet you. Thank you.
Great to meet you too, Marco. बस एक छाव ज़ुल्फ की
बस एक निगाह है प्यार की. The album is Aki Goes to Bollywood. You can check out his live version of that great tune, Ina Mina Dika, at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you right here on The World tomorrow. बस एक निगाह है प्यार की पुकार की चला ये दिल लगी ये शौकिया सलाम की यही तो बात हो रही है काम की कोई तो मुल्क देख लेगा इस तरह कोई नजर तो होगी मेरे नाम की उभारता चला गली गली बाहर की बस एक छाव ज़ुल्फ़ की बस एक निगाह प्यार की PRI Public Radio International.